While the new state budget that begins on July 1st poses tough yet manageable challenges, they pale in comparison to those facing state officials 7 months from now. Ask Governor Ned Lamont and the legislature's Democratic Party how they'll close a projected $4 billion gap over 2 years, likely with nothing left in the rainy day fund, and they'll usually deflect with the same answers. Maybe Congress will approve more aid for states. Perhaps the economy will rebound quickly. But dig a little deeper, and it becomes clear that business-sensitive governor and his more liberal base are headed in opposite directions. Lamont last week was assuring business leaders it's time to rein in spending and keep taxes stable. To discuss this, really the deficit and where we're heading economically here in the state of Connecticut, is our next guest. He is a former colleague of mine in the legislature, in former state senator and lieutenant gubernatorial candidate for lieutenant gubernatorial candidate. Wow, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here. He is Joe Markley. Joe, good morning.
Good morning to you, Gary. You just laid out the situation extremely well.
Thank you.
There was an excellent article yesterday in CT Mirror by Keith Fanoff. I'm sure you know Keith.
Oh, of course,
Capitol.
Yeah.
He was
yeah.
a great reporter on fiscal issues. And, it was a kind of an eye-opener for me, and I think part of it is because there's been so many distractions from our budget problems. Usually those budget problems are kind of the top of the list, but between the virus and then the tremendous unrest and everything that's been going on over the last few weeks,
you know,
I think that... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I think we've been distracted from those fiscal problems, and yet they are still there. And I have to say, I was taken aback by the severity of the situation as it was laid out. One of the things I've been kind of counting on is we said, well, we've got a pretty good rainy day fund.
Yeah.
And the rainy day has now arrived because the tax revenues are so far down thanks to the shutdowns because of the coronavirus. But the truth of it is that the entire rainy day fund is not going to be enough to fill the gap in the budget that starts next week,
right.
The budget that's already set in stone. And then, as you said, beyond that, when the legislature goes back in January, they've got to write budget, a two-year budget that will be $4 billion out of whack. And the amazing thing is, again, just as you're saying, the political response is, oh, well, we'll see what happens. It's because they don't want to talk about it. And, of course, I think we know how they always solve a budget deficit.
Yeah, more taxes.
More taxes. And we might talk about something we can't afford. It's been bad enough, the tax increases that have hit us in what were relatively, in fact, they were extremely good economic times nationally, right? All the time that that I was there, I came in with Malloy in the 2010 election. And so this last 10 years has actually been an excellent time for the economy right up until the virus hit. And yet Connecticut really never got its head above the surface of the water. Then the virus came and our tax revenues dropped by a third. Imagine if you're trying to balance your household income and you say, gee, we're cutting your wages a third. That's a tough thing to deal with, even if you're a tightwad. And now another tax increase on top of that. If there was any chance of recovery, that would be the end of it.
Yeah, and a lot of people just think that we can keep dipping into this rainy day fund because, and I realize we've already gone into it, and we had a we really had a pretty impressive rainy day fund. It was, oh my goodness, what was it, $3 billion?
A little shy of $3 billion, you're
right. Okay, so... we used about, what, half of that or a little less than half of that. And now you could say, well, then that's, $1.5 billion. That's still not too bad. And by all accounts, I'd say you're right. If it was an average, without coronavirus, if it was an average year, that would be still. In other words, already taking half of it out and still remaining $1.5 billion would actually be pretty good. But you start taking away and chipping away at that and dwindling that down, a couple of things are going to happen. Number one, God forbid, if there's another round of this coronavirus, and we need to dip into this reserve for even more emergency purposes, there will be very little left. And number two, doesn't it affect our bond rating?
Yeah, well, you're right about both. And I guess I'd say in response to number one, Gary, so next year's deficit is $2.7 billion. The rainy day fund is going to be about $2.3 billion. So right away, you can say the rainy day fund is going to be gone. It's not going to be diminished. It's, we're going to spend the whole rainy day fund to try to get through next year. And, you know, if there was ever a year that where you deserved to be able to use the rainy day fund, it was this year because of the virus. That was a natural disaster, effectively. But it means that we still have an underlying fiscal problem and we have absolutely no cushion. And as you said, number two is our bond rating has actually been, it's not good, but it's better than it was, in large part because of that rainy day fund. Well, goodbye rainy day fund means goodbye good bond rating. And and if we have no money and we're even more likely to borrow, then the expense of that borrowing is going to be greater. You know, there's talk about at the federal level about allowing states to declare bankruptcy. And really the states that are at the top of that list are California, Connecticut, and Illinois. I was actually contacted by one of the senator's staff that's down in Washington supporting it because they were saying, gee, can we find some people in Connecticut that would back this notion of state bankruptcy because there's the state that needs to do it. But we really are getting ourselves into that spot. And, you know, in the world of selling bonds, if you're thinking about buying bonds, state bonds, and there's talk that maybe states are going to be allowed to declare bankruptcy, and the state you're buying the bond for is one of the states that's in trouble. It's going to be harder and harder to sell these bonds. Mm. We're in a terrible fix, and the response from Lamont and from the Democrats is, we can't worry about it now. Let's wait until we know all the facts. It's because they don't want to talk about it now. What their greatest hope is that nobody talks about the budget until the elections are over in November. Then they can say, oh my goodness, what a surprise. We've got a huge budget deficit.
Yeah, we're talking with former state senator and former candidate for Lieutenant Governor Joe Markley. You know, when you talk about declaring bankruptcy, now, that would allow us to crack open the CBAC agreement and renegotiate, which is all the more reason why the unions would be against filing bankruptcy, because they know that that's a very strong possibility. And you keep in mind that, you know, the unions are in bed with the Democrat Party, and with Lamont being at the helm, I think they're going to fight tooth and nail not to declare bankruptcy for that and other reasons.
Oh, of course. And I don't know that the federal government would allow this. I have at best mixed feelings about it. It's a terrible thing. I mean, it's the same situation as personal bankruptcy. You basically have made obligations, in good faith that you find yourself unable to keep, maybe because of poor financial management. But it's a humiliation, and it also is a tremendous disservice to the people who were counting on the deals that you made. But just like personal bankruptcy or business bankruptcy, there can come a point when the best thing you can do for your creditors is to go to them honestly and say, "Look, I can't. If I have to meet these obligations, you're going to get nothing. But if we can work something out, you know, maybe I can give you 85 cents on the dollar and you'll survive." I feel like that's what the governor has got to do with the unions at this point, to say, it is a shame on our part that we entered into agreements with you that we're not able to honor. But the truth is we're not able to honor them. Let's work out something that hurts your people as little as possible. I mean, part of that, frankly, Gary, I mean, we know there are people getting state pensions over $300,000 a year in retirement. Nobody needs that much retirement income. Any pension renegotiation ought to be based on people's ability to survive on the money they're getting. And it should be based on saying, we're not going to do 10% across the board or something like that. Let's hold harmless the people that are getting reasonable pensions, but let's reduce these outrageous pensions and certainly reduce the obligations that we're committing ourselves to going forward.
Particularly the public sector. I mean, it's our dime. It's our money.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The private sector unions, that's not a part of our fiscal problem.
No, that's not.
And it's a relatively small thing now in the state of Connecticut. There aren't that many private sector union members. It's been going down and down. It's the public sector unions. And again, I don't blame a union for getting the best deal it can. That's their job. And I don't blame the union members for taking a good deal. What I blame are the politicians that did not have the nerve to say no to them. And we were not well served by our governors, Republicans and Democrats. But Dan Malloy may have been the worst, especially because he signed this extension to the CBAC agreement that has locked in subsequent governors. I think one of the things the governors have to do is to say, I'll take the legal risk of making changes in this contract. Other governors did it in this virus crisis and said, I'm canceling the state employee union wage increases. Lamont would not.
He did not. Okay, so based on that, if you could just use that in his way of thinking, I don't see Connecticut declaring bankruptcy. I don't see him renegotiating a CBAC agreement. Cracking that open, going to their leadership and saying, let's renegotiate. Like, to use your example, 85 cents on the dollar. And I want to, talk to your rank and file and talk to your, people and try to get the best deal and hold you as least harmless as we possibly can. But we need to restructure. I don't see that happening. I see tax increases in because of the reasoning that you just mentioned earlier. Huge tax increases.
Well,
huge tax increases.
Yes, huge tax increases. And Gary, this is people don't like to hear partisan rhetoric, but you get it from me sometimes because there's a difference between Republicans and Democrats. And the difference is the Democrats are always going to go for the tax increases. The Republicans aren't perfect. Sometimes they're going to knuckle under too. But at least with the Republicans, you've got a chance. Lamont is not going to be the man to stand up to the unions. The only chance we've got is that in 2 years we get a new governor and maybe things can be corrected before it's too late, if it isn't too late already. But we're going to need somebody that is willing to level with the people of Connecticut. I thought one of the strengths of Reagan was that he could go on TV and say, listen, I know this is unpopular, but this is why I'm doing it. And people would say, yes, that makes sense. And yes, he's sincere. And the other thing is we've got to have somebody who's got the courage of their convictions. And that's the sort of person that could go in and talk turkey with the unions and change the state's direction. But we're headed for the iceberg. And one of the things about trying to change direction of a state is like an ocean liner. You can spin the wheel, but it takes a while before the turn starts to get made. And we don't have much room before it's too late for us.
You know, and you hear of UConn looking to make some changes as well. They're looking at a 15% cut. And the brunt of this has been their athletic department. They're still paying people. And there's still a lot of staffing that's not getting cut. It's the athletic departments that are getting cut. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're trying to get they're asking for reductions at the non-union managerial level. Again, they're stuck with the union contracts, which is most of their employees. And of course, one of the things about UConn is they have gotten out from under the control of the General Assembly. Not that the General Assembly is great at controlling things, but essentially the UConn is governed not by the legislature, but by a board of trustees.
Yeah.
And they come to the legislature and they say, this is our budget. And the legislature gives it to it. And then all the decisions are left to them. There's no, the legislature doesn't have any kind of line item level, control over UConn. I think that's a mistake. We do over the other state, colleges and universities. And UConn has gotten completely out of whack. And, you know, again, it's a sacred cow at Hartford. There's a sense of, oh, you, as a legislator, it's political suicide to vote against UConn. I think we got to get past that. And well, part of it is you have to say, I'm going to do what I think is the right thing to do. Whether it's popular or not, I'll do my best to explain it. But I have to trust that the voters have sense enough to understand that I'm sincerely trying to do the right thing and not simply pandering to them. This is, we're way past the point where we can afford that kind of thing.
Where do we go then? Where do you think, based on Lamont and his history and knowing the needs of the state and the deficit that we're in, talking with Joe Markley right now, what would be the best steps forward, knowing the entire problem as a whole?
Well, honestly, the thing that is most likely to turn the direction in the state right now is in the hands of the people listening to you, the voters of Connecticut, in my opinion, which is to vote for Republican legislators this fall. We've got some great ones running. My dear friend Pam Salamone, who was my aide up at the Capitol,
yeah,
Gary, is running for state legislator in Cheshire. And I know she's got the nerve. She understands how things work. She's got the nerve to do what has to be done. We need to elect some people like that. And we need people to get involved in politics, too, Gary. You know yourself how hard it is to find volunteers, how hard it is to find candidates. It's not, but it's very easy to get involved with a political party, and we need people to do it. If they're frustrated with the Republican Party, become part of it and help it be a stronger party. And then maybe we get some Republican legislators in place. Maybe 2 years from now, we can elect a governor that has the nerve to do what has to be done.
All right. Well, you know as well as I do, Joe, that it's really the independent voters that have
That's
everything
right.
to do with the outcome, with who wins and who loses. How would you appeal? And yet, if you come across, if a Republican comes across as too bipartisan and, too moderate, well, then your base of hardcore conservatives are going to say, well, you're a rhino and you're, forget it, you're not a real Republican. And then you're back at square one again. So then how do you appeal to those independents and sway them your way?
This is a topic for an entire show, Gary. But I would say that one way you do it is people are looking for authenticity. You know, I think the idea that the swing voters are voters who are in the middle of the spectrum is incorrect. And we saw that 4 years ago when a substantial number of people who voted for Sanders